A podcast of the cinema.
You're Alonzo Duralde. My name is Dave White. We are film critics. We're married, and this is the show. You have a little.
I've had a little dry patch on your head.
No. I'm always.
No, I've had this for like the better part of a year, if not longer.
Right here.
Yeah.
This very specific thing, right in that spot.
Uh huh.
You're a liar.
No.
You're actually lying
to
me.
Not noticed.
I am always lovingly touching your body every time I have a chance.
And yet you
And
miss...
now I'm noticing that this little patch of skin on your hand is dry and needs Aquaphor.
It needs emollient
put
so
on
I,
it.
Every so often I goop it up with stuff. Yeah, I think it's where my sleeping splint rubs against my knuckle.
Someone in this house has carpal tunnel syndrome.
It's true.
And sleeps in very scratchy Velcro splints.
They are,
I'll tell you, that's the time when I don't want to touch you. Because it's hard to get the Velcro on me.
They weren't scratchy when they were new, but you know how Velcro is.
Oh, no. Scratchy even when new.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, please. I'm the expert on how it feels.
Well, not the expert on my hand issues.
Your terrible Velcro hands all over me.
My terrible Velcro hands.
You have terrible Velcro hands in the night.
Welcome to a slice of domesticity, everybody.
We are going to begin this episode with letters.
Yes.
Because we have one that is serious.
Yes.
And we want to address it. And then we have a couple others that are also, well, no, all three of them are serious. But only one of them involves us being in trouble. So let's start with that one.
Please.
This is from Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Dave. Hello, Alonzo. My name is Victoria, and I'm a longtime listener. I even wrote to you once a couple years ago. In your last episode, do we need to stop and close that window so that the garbage truck that's coming up and down our street isn't going to make this a nightmare?
Sure, let's do it.
All right.
City of West Hollywood's like, Alonzo and Dave are taping a podcast this morning. Let's send out the garbage trucks.
Yeah, okay. All right, we will continue.
Yes.
In your last episode, you discussed the documentary Welcome to Chechnya, which I, as a queer Russian woman, still cannot make myself watch.
Fair enough.
Some Russians already have, and of course the common reaction is, I knew that it was going to be horrible, but I didn't know... Sorry. I knew that it was going to be horrible, but now I don't know how I will be able to sleep after watching it.
Mm.
I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's very bleak here these days. 2020 is not easy on anyone. The people are not as obedient or leader-worshipping as many like to think, and right now, we not only have to find ways to survive under an authoritative government, but also fight against the Westerners' idea of Russia as a backward country full of unintelligent czar's subjects. It's very easy to write us off as irrelevant or unworthy of respect or compassion when we are basically still the butt of jokes foreigners have been telling for decades. And since we're backward and not important, it's okay to dismiss us and say insensitive stuff all the time. I know that both of you know and love Russian directors, and it's hard to accuse you of being ignorant or closed-minded. I'm interrupting the letter now. I don't think we can be accused of being closed-minded necessarily, but ignorant, oh sure.
Oh, we'll take it.
Absolutely ignorant about things. And more importantly, I think to the point of this letter, thoughtless.
Yes.
Because we're dummies, and sometimes we get going, and we get going fast talking, and especially an emotional subject like this, because we are both queer, and it frightens us.
Yes.
You know, we just start talking and we say thoughtless things.
Yes.
I will continue with the letter. That's why when Alonso said, "I hope that in the eyes of the world, that more civilized nations will see this film and take steps to protect these people," my heart sank to the floor and I couldn't really think of anything else for the rest of the episode. I'm interrupting just a little bit here. The next sentence in the letter is a direct quote that our horrible garbage president said. And because it was said on the news at the time, without interruption and without censoring, I too am going to say it. It's profanity. I know people are not used to that on this show. We're not going to edit it out. Here we go. Do you remember the outrage? I'm now continuing the letter, just so everyone understands. Do you remember the outrage everyone felt when your president called African countries shithole countries? Is setting Russia in opposition with, quote, more civilized nations that much different? Nobody's going to create a scandal about it, and most people will not even blink an eye hearing those words, so I decided to speak up. And just to be clear, I am not comparing negative stereotypes about Russia to racism. I know that I don't have whole institutions created to discriminate against me because of the color of my skin. I've made a point of educating myself for years on the subject. I know better than that. I write not to shame you or accuse you of anything. I only ask you to find more compassion and maybe better words for us. Russians, especially those under 35, often find themselves in a situation where, on the one hand, our desire to be a part of a wider world isn't appreciated by our government. And on the other, the wider world often doesn't see in us anything more than vodka, bears, balalaika, and Putin. I haven't traveled much, but when I did, I was always asked about Putin, about me being his presumed supporter, about Crimea, which is a whole separate load of fun for me with my Ukrainian mother, about us drinking all the time, even though it's not true, and only a negative thing when they say about us drinking all the time, even though it's not true, and is only a negative thing when they say it about Russians. Australians, for example, are regarded as a lot of fun, and they know how to party when they drink. I had never thought about that.
Yeah.
But that's a fact. That's a fact. Like, you think of people drinking in Russia as like this sad, miserable alcoholism, and you think about people in Australia drinking as,
woohoo,
Chris Hemsworth knows how to get down. Mm. You know what I mean? I hadn't considered that before. Recently, I'm continuing the letter now. Recently, there's been a discussion on Twitter between a so-called Russia expert, Mark Galeotti, and some actual Russians about the title and the cover of his new book, A Short History of Russia, From Pagans to Putin. The person who presents my country and people to the non-Russian-speaking world couldn't understand the backlash and actively argued that limiting our thousand-year history to pagans and an authoritarian leader and putting a bear in a crown on the cover is not a big deal and is actually not a negative image of Russia, but a shorthand for his readers. The discussion itself was in English, which is pretty ironic, all by itself. For the last 10 days, I've read articles in English where probably the most rigged vote of the last 20 years was presented as simply an election where we, silly, obedient Slavs, voted for our leader to stay in power until 2036. Do you see how it all piles up? And don't even get me started on the representation of Russia and Russians on screen. John Wick is called Baba Yaga in the first movie. Baba literally means woman or even old woman. What the hell? I wouldn't write this if I didn't feel so utterly tired of this constant need to explain myself to everyone whose values I assumedly share. I've also come to understand that we need to be more vocal if we want the situation to change. I sincerely love your podcast and look forward to every 10-minute tangent about the post office or a donut stand, and you always put me in a good mood, so I will tune in for every new episode, but I hope you'll hear me and at least give it a thought. I also apologize for the size of this email, my rambling thoughts, and very creative use of commas. I swear English punctuation is going to be the death of me. Yours sincerely, Victoria.
A lot to unpack here, but obviously the lead is I messed up. I'm sorry, I said a dumb thing. And I said a dumb thing because, and this is not an excuse for the dumb thing, but just this is the background of the dumb thing. When it comes to LGBT civil rights violations, be they in states of the United States or other countries or parts of the world, I become kind of a single issue voter. And that becomes the thing I focus on and the thing that I think about and that I associate with the region in question. I said something that was dumb. I said something that was blanketing an entire people under the decisions of its government. And obviously, the citizenry and the ruling powers are always separate things. And the citizenry very often is more progressive and is more welcoming and, you know, is better on the world stage than necessarily the people who are making the decisions. So I certainly in no way meant to imply that the Russian people were at fault for any of this, or that, anyway, I said was dumb, and I apologize.
The word civilized is often used, you know, to civilized or uncivilized is often used to disparage a country that you don't know enough about.
Sure, absolutely.
And so to say that a country is uncivilized is to discount its culture, its art, its people, everything.
Yes.
So that word in particular is when, and honestly, I'd have to go back and listen to the recording, but I probably sat there and said, like, so I'm at fault too, and I apologize as well. The, because it isn't true. It isn't true.
Yeah.
I've been given this letter. You handed it to me this morning and I read it and I've been thinking about it. And, I often think, and I do often think about this, the way other people in other countries see the United States.
Absolutely.
And I will always remember going the first day I was in London in 1989 was the day that George Old Bush,
H.W.
George H.W. Bush was being inaugurated. And the inauguration was on the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And people were watching it in the little TV room at the residence hall where I was living. And I walked in, I'm brand new. I've just eaten my first meal there. And I sat down and other people were talking and I said, why are you guys watching this? And they said, you're American? And I said, yes. They said, did you vote for him? And I was like, no, I voted against him. And they said, but why are you watching this? And they said, well, he's our new president too, isn't he? For the next 30 minutes, they spent their time asking me every single wild question about life in the United States. And how could we all behave this way?
How many guns do you own?
Yeah, how many guns do you have? How many, you know, it's like, why did you vote for Reagan? And I was like, I voted against him too. So it was a lesson.
Sure.
And one that I try to remember. Sometimes I don't remember it. Sometimes you also don't remember it.
Correct.
The bottom line here is for you, Victoria, you are our queer sister.
Yes.
And so what we want for you and other queer people in Russia and throughout the world, if they live in countries where the official position is, you know, domination and persecution of queer people, you know, we want to do whatever we can do to support that.
Yes.
To support our queer family. By not saying idiotic things on a podcast.
For starters, yes.
That's the first
top
and easiest.
The list.
That's the first and easiest thing we can do. So yeah. Thank you for being so gentle with your correction. And it's one thing I love about y'all who listen is that when we are saying dumb things and you do write us and tell us, you're always so nice to us.
Yes.
Because, you know, we're not bad. We're just not smart sometimes.
Yes.
So thank you.
That was a very kind approbation.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. I deserve worse.
Oh, you deserve way worse.
Yeah.
You ate the whole strawberry rhubarb Kringle that we were saving for 15 minutes.
I wondered how long it was going to take
you have
to bring this into the conversation.
Ruined my life today. I woke up, I went to bed last night thinking about how delicious it was going to be for breakfast. And somebody got home from his late night walk with friend and neighbor Gary Cotty. They stay about 12 feet apart from each other while they're walking on the empty streets of West Hollywood. Because by the way, California is locking it down again.
Yes.
So those traffic was much lighter last night
than it's been for the last week or two.
Anyway, someone got home from his walk. I was asleep like a good and virtuous person. Do you know what I was dreaming about? Strawberry rhubarb pastry that was sitting on the counter waiting to be shared. Shared by two people in love. Listener, do you understand what happened next? Would you like to know? The hungry walking exercise man came home and shoved the entire thing into his greedy, greedy mouth.
Yes, my maw.
Smacking his lips, drooling on the floor.
I barely chewed it. I just crammed the whole thing in at one go.
Ravenous animal noises that should have woken me up. But no. So when I woke up this morning all with cheer and joy and anticipation of a beautiful day in my heart. And I got out here and I saw zero amounts of strawberry rhubarb Kringle pastry.
I'm sorry.
I rent my garment. Sorry, mine. I rent my garment.
With an option to own.
I mean, the tea that I had that I was going to have with the pastry, the tea was still fine.
I thought you had had seconds at some point. So.
No, you had seconds at some point, and then you had thirds.
Think of it as...
No, you think about how you're going to make this up. No. How are you going to make it up to me?
Please, if we're going to look at the debit sheet of all the stuff that you like polished off without telling me or decided that I wasn't doing it fast enough and it was just sitting there in the refrigerator, then I think I still am way ahead of you.
You've committed a crime against love.
So there.
So you think about what you've done.
Uh-huh.
And figure out how you're going to make it up to me. We have another letter.
Yes.
Would you like to hear it?
Please.
Okay. Jordan. I think Dave really hit the nail on the head. Oh, say that again, Jordan. When he said that Hamilton gives voice to the titular character's personal moral failings and not the public ones, which are even more than you stated. Oh, I know. There's a list. We didn't get to the whole list. He continues, Hamilton wanted presidents to serve life terms, and he basically started Wall Street and American capitalism. I do think, however, that the show was never very interested in the public failings of any of these real people. All the politics of the show are a lot more related to the characters themselves, how their politics affect them emotionally. The show doesn't take us inside the room where it happens. The story Lynn is telling is a lot less about that and more about these fictionalized versions of real people. I understand anyone who thinks that the history the show details could have been more accurate. But for me, it's a story and not a documentary, with changes that are more convenient for the story they're trying to tell. Hamilton and Eliza had 8 kids, for example, as opposed to the show's 1. There's always people who will take the history of it at face value, but I think most of us are smart enough to realize that these are fictionalized versions of people. For everyone talking about Hamilton's idealization, I think George Washington is much more idealized in the show as a man who actually did own slaves, yet it's because his function in the story is that of role model. This might be dishonest to the theme of legacy that the show is so concerned with, because it removes part of the legacy that these founding fathers have to have. But the show's tight pace might be sacrificed with just the addition of one or two more songs that reckon with it. It's already nearly 3 hours long. I do think, however, that the casting choices reckon with this legacy in a very interesting way, by making these people represented it... I'll read English now. By making these people represented by characters of color in a show that has become such a pop culture phenomenon, more people in this generation, at least, will probably associate Thomas Jefferson with David Diggs's face than his actual one. And thinking of how the Founding Fathers would react if they got to peek ahead in time and see how they would be represented makes me laugh. They would probably be enraged by this portrayal, yet there's nothing they could do to stop it. And to me, at least, that's worth it. Oh, sorry, that's worth a lot,
yeah,
is what he says.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, a second message I got via text from Gerald about mm-hmm. Hamilton was the presentation of the representation of King George.
Mm-hmm.
He was initially unhappy about Jonathan Groff's very queenie,
foppish,
prissy portrayal
mm-hmm.
of King George. Now, I didn't have a problem with that, just because...
I didn't read it as gay, per se. I thought of it as more sort of an aristocratic, foppish...
effete kind
yeah.
of thing. I'll tell you what it comes down to for me mm-hmm. when this sort of thing happens. Who's the actor?
Well, sure, yeah.
All right, so here's the example he and I talked about. Groff, completely out as a gay actor,
mm-hmm.
And a big deal on Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he goes... I'm going to guess at this point in Jonathan Groff's Broadway career,
mm-hmm.
maybe not necessarily his acting career in film and television, but on Broadway, I bet you Jonathan Groff just gets offers.
Oh, sure.
He gets offers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so...
you can sell a show around him.
And so at this point, if he doesn't want to do something, he's not going to do it.
Right.
So there are those kind of two factors involved. When an openly queer actor leans into stereotype,
mm-hmm.
I think that I understand why, depending on the character.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at, say, Scott Thompson's Buddy Cole character on Kings
right.
in the Hall, for
yeah.
instance.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is different because it's a villain, but it's still like he is.
Well, you know how I love a treacherous gay.
Oh, well, of course.
Anyway, so here's the other example he gave. We were like, he was like, what about that movie where Cary Grant is sort of like mincing around and being like queer acting? And I said, here's the difference.
Yeah.
Cary Grant was closeted bisexual his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Denied it when it came up.
Yeah.
Treated ex-boyfriends very, very badly.
Well,
homophobically.
One of them, anyway.
At least one of them.
Yeah.
Ori Kelly.
Yes.
Fashion designer, wardrobe designer for films,
yeah.
Ori Kelly, was cruel to Ori Kelly in front of other people in a homophobic way.
Yeah.
And I think to myself, if I see Cary Grant just going gay all of a sudden, what's that film?
That's Bringing Up Baby.
Bringing Up Baby. I think, you know what, dude?
You're trying too hard.
F you. Go sit over there.
Go watch.
Go sit in the corner and think about who you are and what you've done.
Go watch the documentary Women He's Undressed if you want to know more about Ori Kelly.
And I dig Cary Grant, but
yeah.
when that stuff comes up,
sure.
I think you were sometimes very, very bad.
Yeah. I'm sure he was always nice to Randolph Scott, but he was not nice
to Ori
Kelly.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was nice to Randolph Scott because Randolph Scott was like...
a peer. You know,
yeah.
And also, Randolph Scott played it as close to the vest as Cary Grant did,
exactly.
Whereas Ori Kelly never bothered to be in the closet.
Ori Kelly was not closeted,
yeah.
At least on the job. You know,
if he wasn't closeted on the job, I don't know where he
you
would
You know
be.
What I mean.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but getting back to stereotypically queer portrayals.
Yes.
I take it on a case by case.
Absolutely.
And I want, you know... I want that actor to give me the nod that they know, that I know, that I'm...
Yes.
We all know, and they know that we're watching them.
Yeah.
You know, and how they do their job.
Totally. Shall I read this other... it's a Twitter thread. I wouldn't call it a letter.
Oh, please, please, because it's about disclosure, is
yes,
it not?
Yes, it is, yes.
Absolutely.
So this is from B, by the way. Happy Non-Binary Awareness Day, I found out on Twitter.
Today. Is that, that's today?
That is a thing that is happening today.
Happy day to our non-binary friends.
Yes. B writes, I just listened to your review of Disclosure, and if you're asking me, and I know this wasn't really the focus of the doc, but I felt that non-binaries were left out of the conversation. If we hadn't been mentioned at all, that's one thing, but we were once. And that one time wasn't at the end, it was like 10 minutes in. It just made me feel like we were just a footnote. Non-binaries are part of the trans community. It's just that in terms of representation, we haven't had to deal with harmful representation. We've had to live with none at all.
Right.
Disclosure is a great doc. I just think it's funny how when I finished it, I was left wishing I had seen myself in it. Interesting observation. I had not thought about that.
Well, that's why when we reviewed it, we said, tell us what they left out.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And they really, you're right. They did leave out a lot of that.
I mean, I think the challenge is if you're a documentary that is about representation and there's no representation to talk about, then that leaves you talking about how there's no representation, which they should obviously have done.
There's a little now.
I was going to say.
Asha Kate
Dillon on Billions.
Billions.
On One Day at a Time, the lesbian daughter has a person friend who identifies as non-binary
okay.
and uses they, them pronouns.
I haven't been watching this season. So
this was for a while now.
Really?
Yeah. At least like but season two, I think.
I thought I watched up until the end of season two.
Maybe you haven't.
Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
Maybe you don't. Anyway.
But you're right. It's not negative. It's
invisibility.
It just doesn't. Yeah.
And so if a documentary about visibility left you feeling invisible, then that is a failing of that documentary.
Yeah. Now let's talk about Le Current Cinema.
Why not?
Palm Springs.
Yes.
It's from the Lonely Island people.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Andy Samberg.
Yes.
And her name?
Christina... Kristen Milioti.
Kristen Milioti, who is my favorite person in the film.
She's quite good.
Yeah, she really is. In a film that I don't super care for, but... Why don't you explain what it's about and what happened?
Sure. So it premiered at Sundance this year and actually broke the record for biggest sale at Sundance, which I think kind of has...
How much did they spend on it?
Well, they beat out the prior record by 69 cents.
Everybody benefits.
I think something like 22 million, something insane, which is not like... I don't want to contextualize the movie in that regard, but it is a thing that happened.
Is that joke ever going to be good? Or is it always going to be dumb? It's like when you say duty.
You're the only one who thinks that's a joke even in the first place.
What, duty?
Yes.
No, duty is actually a joke.
Okay, fine.
And it's a funny one.
Okay.
If you're seven.
Well, there you go.
The new Haim CD record just came out.
Uh-huh.
And the cover is them behind the counter at Cantor's.
Uh-huh.
Wearing like aprons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it says now the now serving thing is now serving number 69.
Oh. I mean, I think it has crossed the barrier to where the fact that the joke isn't funny is funny.
Yeah.
That it's such an obvious sort of sniggering, like, you know, winky wink thing.
Yeah.
That the joke is that somebody would make that joke. I don't know.
Right.
Anyway, so Palm Springs. Begins with what would appear to be a sort of, you know, it is in the Groundhog Day genre. It is about people who are trapped in a time loop where they live the same day over and over again. This has been going on with Andy Samberg for quite some time now, but he accidentally drags Kristen Milioti's character into it. They are both in Palm Springs for a wedding. His unfaithful and generally awful girlfriend is one of the bridesmaids. Chris Imeliati's character is the sister of the bride and matron of honor, or maid of honor, rather. And, you know, once she gets trapped into this day with Andy Samberg, she goes through all the steps to try and figure out how to get out of it, where he is sort of resigned to it and is like, nope, tried that. It's not going to work. Why are you bothering? And, you know, their relationship goes from being purely platonic and friendly to more intimate. And when it becomes more intimate, it gives him perhaps more of an impetus to try and break out of it. And it, you know, it basically is using this framework that we recognize. It's not trying to be Groundhog Day again, but it's using it as a metaphor for, you know, the way people live their life and the way they get stuck in ruts and the way that they don't break out of repetitive situations or, you know, trying to aspire to something different or, you know, potentially scary or whatever. And I think in a very low key way, it's very effective at telling that story.
I think the concept done before in other films.
Sure.
But that's not a problem.
Yeah.
First half of the film, I thought it was, you know, explored in a fun and silly way. Shout out to Andy Samberg for bottoming for another man in one scene.
Yes.
Which is, you know,
quietly subversive.
Talk about representation.
Yeah.
That's the kind of representation I'm about, you know.
Oh, wait till you see The Old Guard.
Okay.
Which we'll talk about next
week. I have not yet watched it, but I will. The and then the second half, it turns into the, you know, the analog for life, y'all. And I don't need to learn something from Lonely Island. I need to be amused in an absurdist way, which I believe the film accomplished in the first half, and then decides to become boringly, you know, gender specific in the second half about who wants what. What does a man want? What does a lady want? Like, it's just, it's so...
I think you're being dismissive.
I am being dismissive because I want to dismiss the second half of this movie. It amused me somewhat. I thought, you know, I laughed a few times. But it's, overall, it's not an especially interesting or vital film. And not funny enough to make me forgive it for that problem.
Oh, well, I disagree. I mean, I don't want to like overhype this movie. I think it is a film of small pleasures, but there are pleasures, and I think that it is funny, and I think it is insightful in its way about what it's trying to say. And I think if it hadn't tried to say something, we would just think, oh well, this is Groundhog Day, we've seen it. And even Groundhog Day, I think, is saying things, and we tend to forget that because we sort of focus on the big comic set pieces and, you know, Ned Ryerson or whatever, but I mean, that is also a movie that is a metaphor about a lot of things. So yeah, I think it's effective. I think it, you know, it's got a really great cast of character actors. J.K. Simmons plays a principal role, but you also get like Dale Dickey and Peter Gallagher.
Ah, yes, Dale Dickey. That was exciting.
It's always good to
see
Dale
Dickey.
I love
it when she's in a movie.
Yeah.
And even if it is always a small role,
Yeah.
She's very cool.
She's dynamite. So, you know, I think this is fine. I think that, you know, it's the kind of movie that would have gotten, like, as an indie, you know, and if it didn't have the whole, like, Sundance price tag thing hanging over its head, I think it would have been, like, fine, and people would have talked about it for a bit, and then it would maybe eventually kind of develop a cult following in the way that Popstar has that I still do not understand.
I love Popstar.
I think there's a funny idea in Popstar, and obviously the song parodies are great because that's what Lonely Island does.
Yeah.
But I think that movie structurally is a mess. I think it is one of those like, hey, we're going to improv, and then we're going to cut it together later, and we're going to cast these really awesome people, but then not use them because their bits didn't really work, and then it's going to be 85 minutes, and it's going to not go anywhere. So I think that movie is been crazily overrated by certain corners of the internet. And you know, this one,
I would like to say that your face is crazily overrated by certain corners of the internet.
My face doesn't get nearly enough credit on the internet. You know, and it's weird now, especially now, like, you know, these movies come out that were gonna go theatrical, or that seemed like they'd be the kind that would go theatrical, and they, you know, premiere on Hulu or Netflix, and everybody's got big opinions about them, you know.
Right.
They're the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. You know, we're going to talk about Old Guard next week, which I think has a lot going for it.
We should talk about it this week, but I didn't get around to seeing it yet. I tried watching First Cow,
yes,
but the link went all haywire and the captions covered the entire screen.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, you turned it on, the screen was full of captions, and then I turned it off, and when I turned it back on again, there were no captions whatsoever.
So that was weird.
And it's a movie where everyone's whispering half the time.
So we're going to try to get that fixed so that I can finally, yes, watch First Cow.
Yes.
Yeah. Go
so
on.
Those are coming.
Those
up.
Are coming
anyway,
next time.
So, but just the opinions on, like, film Twitter about oh, this is great. You're wrong. It sucks. It's like, hey guys, maybe the truth lies in between somewhere. Maybe both, you know, Palm Springs and Old Guard, which are interestingly connected in terms of, I think, certain plot elements, but they're totally different genre wise. You know, I think these films have things going for them, and they're not perfect, and, like, let's maybe appreciate them on the level at which they exist. And I think there's a lot to like in Palm Springs, and I liked what it had to say about what it had to say.
There are some things to like about Palm Springs. Kristen Milioti, who I didn't really know much about until this time.
She has not been on my radar before, but now I
now
think
she is.
Absolutely.
I think she's terrific. As the character who gets unwittingly dragged into the infinite time loop.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize until halfway through the movie that her sister, the one who's getting married, is played by Camila Mendes, who is Veronica on Riverdale.
Shut up. Yeah. I did not recognize her at all.
That's who that is, yeah.
Wow.
Because I kept looking at her face going, I know you, I know you, how do I know you? So then I went and looked her up.
Oh, and the groom was one of the Teen Wolf boys.
Oh, really?
That Tyler Hoechlin guy.
Certainly never have watched Teen Wolf.
And I believe the gentleman who penetrates Andy Samberg in this movie is married
with love.
Yeah, with love and consent. Is married to Adi Bryant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't know that either. So many things I don't know.
Yes. And yet you talk and talk and talk.
Here's my favorite line from the film.
Okay.
When Andy Samberg is explaining that they're in this infinite time loop.
Mm-hmm.
And that what that means to them personally is that nothing they do matters.
Right.
He then says, your best bet is to learn how to suffer existence.
Are you going to have that, needle pointed onto a sampler?
Not only does that actually tip the scale for me to make me think, this movie is more good than bad, even though I'm going to say I don't really believe that. But it is the most accurate line of dialogue from any film that has been released in 2020.
I mean, the motto of the year, I think, is the one for the Japanese roller coasters.
Scream inside your heart.
Yes.
Yes.
But that's a close second.
It's close.
Sure.
Close. But yeah, you guys, Dale Dickey.
Always Dale Dickey.
I love her face so much.
Yeah.
Because she looks like so many people related to me.
She is Texas.
Is she from Texas?
I'm not sure, actually. She might be from, like, Kentucky. Hang on, I will tell you. No, Knoxville, Tennessee?
Tennessee. Okay, well, she just has that amazing face that just reminds me of so many people I know. From New Mexico and Texas.
Yes.
So, when I see her in a film, I'm just, you look, it's Dale Dickey. All right. Greyhound.
Oh, boy.
That's right. I love films like this, even if they're not great, which is what this is. This is not great.
As Matt actually called it, it's the mother of all dad movies.
A joke that people are taking a little too literally on the internet and correcting him and saying, don't you mean the father of all dad movies? Like, no, the joke is the mock. Okay, now we're explaining the joke and nothing matters.
Exactly. Nothing makes a joke sore like explaining it.
It's from a filmmaker named Aaron Schneider.
Yes, I do not know his work.
I'm not familiar with him.
He did a film called The Lowdown with Robert Duvall and Bill Murray.
Okay.
Which is an interesting combo. I never saw it, though.
It stars Tom Hanks. It stars Elizabeth Shue in a very tiny little role.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Graham, who's a British character actor that you will never know is British because he's always playing someone who sounds like they're on Boardwalk Empire. And I think he was on Boardwalk Empire. Well, and
as you said it to remind me who he was, The Irishman, Florida. Shorts.
Yeah.
See, that's why you're good at celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah. Francoise Dorliac.
That's why you're terrible at celebrity.
That's why I'm the king of celebrity. We're going to get to some Francoise Dorliac adjacent material,
yes,
in just
momentarily,
a moment.
Yes.
So Tom Hanks is much too old to be in the position that his character is in right now, because he's like getting his first command of a ship.
Right. Like,
and he's like 65.
Yeah, the idea if the idea is like Tom Hanks is a ship captain in World War II,
yeah,
sure, fine.
Right.
But if the idea is Tom Hanks has just gotten his first assignment as a ship captain after Pearl Harbor, it's like, what's he been doing up till now?
Maybe there's some dialogue that we missed that explained why.
This is based on a book, and maybe that's got some explanation.
Okay.
Maybe it's some deal where, like, oh no, Pearl Harbor happened, and so now we're suddenly
people who
thrusting are older, you know, people who are on the verge of retirement into leadership
and
positions.
Maybe people who haven't done that particular job. I don't know. But like, yeah,
the movie doesn't tell you.
Something got left out. Or at least maybe we weren't listening at the same time.
However, that aside, the movie also begins with Tom Hanks and Elizabeth Shue discussing the possibility of getting married and when that's going to happen. It's like, again, you're 60.
And this is your first. I mean, it could happen.
I mean, and like, no one's talking about like that you're both widowed or something.
Yeah,
but
it's
very strange.
No information about what their relationship was
until
now.
This movie should star Colin Hanks.
Chet Hayes.
He's in it. We missed him, but he's in there somewhere.
I think he's billed as Chet Hanks.
I believe he is.
But you know, I bet it doesn't matter to him. I bet he ain't even tripping.
He ain't even tripping.
So Tom Hanks is on a boat and he has to go from America,
speaking of Lonely Island,
to England.
He's
with
on a
the
boat.
The boat, it's just a supply ship.
It's part of I think he's part of it's a convoy, and his boat is part of the defense of the supply ships.
Okay.
That are crossing the Atlantic. And it's this zone where it's too far out for planes from either the US or the UK to protect them. So it's all up to the Tom Hanks boat.
And the submarines are coming.
The U-boats.
To get Tom Hanks and the boat.
Yes.
So
Thomas Kretschmann is reading propaganda in English over the radio waves.
Okay, first of all, this movie stars Tom Hanks. In the plus column. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this movie is about World War II. In the plus column. Thirdly, this movie has submarines in it. Super in the plus column.
Also, this movie is 90 minutes.
It could have been 3 hours.
Oh.
That's how much I love this kind of thing.
You are such a dad about this stuff. I don't know why.
I don't know why either, but I just am. Partially Ken Burns' fault, but not entirely. It's the fault of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which I saw when I was a little child, and is to this day my favorite, the greatest Disney live-action film. And
so if Kirk Douglas came out in a tight shirt playing an accordion and singing to Peter Lorre, you would have really loved this movie.
That's less important than that. Octopus,
which
is my favorite animal. So, if you have a movie, I will watch any dumb old World War II movie on TCM. I don't care what it is. I'll watch it. If it's made in the 40s, about World War II, set then, like made later in decades later, but it's about World War II, I don't know what that is. I don't know what it says about me. I can't get enough of it. It started, honestly, it started with when I was a kid and I read The Diary of Anne Frank.
Oh, okay.
And I was like,
that's a leap.
I need to know more. No, it's not a leap at all. They're absolutely connected. And so
I get it, but it's, you know.
All the things that were happening in that moment in history are things I'm interested in.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And so, and they kind of always have been.
Okay.
So, you know, my love of that Ken Burns documentary is obviously formally and subject matter wise not the same, but, you know, watching Shoah and learning about all of that.
I kind of feel like that just being living in the 20th century, in the latter half of the 20th century, that World War II is just like the water we all swam in. Like, you didn't even have to go looking for it. It was just constantly there.
However, by the time, you know, I was born, it was, you know, decades later. And when you grow up in the United States post-World War II, yeah, a lot of things are informed by it, but you don't necessarily know everything about it.
Well, sure.
You're not always taught everything about it that you know about what happened here in the States, what happened amongst, you know, the people who are actually fighting.
Sure.
What was going on with, you know, the concentration camps. Like, so all of these things together become one package of stuff that you want to learn about if you're me.
What I mean is, you and I both grew up, we were born in the 60s, grew up in the 70s and 80s. World War II as a subject has always been surrounding us, I feel like. You know, movies about it, TV shows about it, you know, books about it. Documentaries about it.
Doesn't mean anyone was, doesn't, it doesn't mean you're paying attention.
No, I understand that. And if you're into it and you want to learn more about it, then it's all there for you to explore. But I'm just saying, I feel like it's like people who are super fans of a thing that is already like the most popular of that thing. Like, you didn't have to go hunt it down. You just got out of bed and there it was. You know, like, World War II, I just feel like it's constantly been staring me in the face as a subject in the culture for our entire lives.
That is correct. And also, you can ignore it entirely as a moment in history if you feel like it. Doesn't matter that it's everywhere.
True.
You can still ignore it.
All right, fair enough.
I chose to pay attention to all that stuff.
Okay.
I'm just fascinated by it.
All right.
Having said all of that,
Greyhound is whatever.
This film is kind of a bunch of whatever. But it does have some exciting, and I tell you, it's a movie about being chased.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much all that happens.
Yeah, it is one of those films that is like, there are no B plots in this movie. It is very directly about the thing that it is about, and the thing happens, and then the thing ends, and then the movie's over.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that kind of filmmaking, and on that sort of level of direct intensity, it does often succeed. And I love Tom Hanks's love of analog technology.
Yes.
This is a movie with like clicky buttons and grease pencils and, you know,
levers.
You know, yeah, levers, exactly. Like people having to play telephone, yeah. You know, like somebody yells something in the downstairs map room to the guy on the deck who then yells it to Tom Hanks, who then yells the thing back, and then that guy yells it to the other room. Like, all that stuff is really kind of interesting. And the fact that it's early in the war and they haven't quite ironed out all the kinks, so it's like, it's super cold in the North Atlantic, and our windshield wipers are frozen and our radar isn't pinging, and like all these things, and they have to sort of do these workarounds, which is very of the Apollo 13 school of like, all right, right, we have a binder and some duct tape and two socks, and how do we turn that into a thing that's going to keep them alive, you know?
But it's short, so
it is.
They get chased for 90 minutes and then they aren't chased anymore, and then it's done.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, it's reasonably exciting to watch.
Yeah. It does deliver.
They're going for a Dunkirk kind of situation, I think, in terms of its formal qualities.
Dunkirk focused on one group of people.
Right. And you know, it's not, you know...
Dunkirk.
It ain't no Dunkirk.
No.
But, you know, if you're me, and this is your thing, why not enjoy Greyhound?
Sure. If you get Apple TV Plus, do you get Apple TV Plus?
We don't.
Does anyone get Apple TV Plus?
We just got a screener link from the publicist. We do not get Apple TV Plus.
Yeah.
So if anyone out there has Apple TV Plus...
Greyhound, won't you?
And you have the same taste in this sort of thing that I do. You only have to watch it for 90 minutes.
And if you have any vodka and grapefruit juice at your house, you can have a Greyhound.
Is that what a Greyhound is, mm-hmm. as a drink? Vodka and grapefruit juice?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had that?
I have.
When?
Years ago.
I've never seen you have that in my whole life.
I had a vodka period.
My whole life is only 25 years.
I was born the day I met you.
That's a fact.
And if you salt the rim of a Greyhound, it's a salty dog.
Drink names are hilarious to me.
Yeah.
Mostly because I don't
drink.
Drink. Much.
You don't drink cocktails.
I never drink a cocktail.
Yeah.
They're not...
You're wine and beer.
They don't taste good to me. I like scotch, and I like wine, and I like beer. Mm-hmm. And I say that with qualification, because...
You like scotch annually.
Because I haven't had any of those things. No. We had a bottle of wine at the beginning of the lockdown, the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gone now.
Yeah, like
and we haven't bought any.
A lot of people bought a ton of booze, and that was just not our. We were buying like, bags of chocolate chips.
We were buying lots of flour and rice and beans and chocolate chips. Yeah, pretty much. Lots of butter to put in the freezer. We weren't stocking up on booze.
Yeah. No judgment. It's just, you know, our thing.
That's right. Why are we talking about this? Oh, the drinks. Yeah. I want to discuss my favorite movie of the batch. Of course, there are only three that we're talking about this week. But the new film from Hirokazu Koreeda.
Yes.
It is called The Truth.
Mm-hmm.
It is his first English language film. Am I correct about that?
It's his first non-Japanese language film, because it's in English and French. And it's his first film shot outside of Japan.
You're right. It's in English and French, and his first one shot outside of Japan.
Yeah.
Okay. It stars Françoise Dorléac's sister.
Yes, you may have heard of her.
Catherine Deneuve. Juliette Binoche.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan Hawke.
Yes.
Ludivine Sagnier.
Mm-hmm.
French actress that... If you watch enough French movies, you'll recognize. And
she was in Swimming Pool and Eight Women.
Know who she is. Oh, how I like this.
It's right up your alley. Like more than Greyhound is up your alley, this is up your alley. And mine too.
Catherine Deneuve plays an actress who is exactly like Catherine Deneuve. In fact, her character's name is Fabian.
Yes.
That is Catherine Deneuve's real middle name.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. At one point in this film, Catherine Deneuve gives a dress to someone.
Mm-hmm.
A vintage black dress with a white Peter Pan collar. It is the dress that Catherine Deneuve wore in Belle de Jour.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
There is so much in this film where Catherine Deneuve is basically like, it's the being John Malkovich for Catherine Deneuve.
Well, but here's the thing. I think there's a lot about that character that she would be the first to tell you is not like her.
Of course. But what I really want to know from Catherine Deneuve is...
Which parts are like you?
Are you this terrible... Are you this mean? Like, I guess only Chara Mastroianni knows for sure.
Probably.
But Juliette Binoche plays Catherine Deneuve's daughter.
Yes.
Who
is a writer.
Is a screen. She writes screenplays.
Yeah.
And she lives in the United States with her actor husband, who is played by Ethan Hawke. And so Juliette Binoche and Ethan Hawke, they come back to France with their little daughter, played by a kid who's this her first film.
Oh, she's good.
And a kid, a grandchild who looks like what you think Catherine Deneuve looked like when she was 9. You know what I mean? Like, you're looking at this child, you're going, are you actually related to Catherine Deneuve? Because, I mean, like, you could grow up to be her.
Well, you know, it's weird. You mentioned Chiara Mastroianni, her daughter. Like, when she was younger, you saw elements of both Catherine Deneuve and Marcello Mastroianni in her looks. But as she is maturing, we just saw her in
the new Christophe Honoré film.
Yeah, which I've now forgotten the title of. she looks so much like Catherine Deneuve now.
Isn't it called, like, On a Magical Night or something?
On a Magical Night, okay, yes, yeah. You're right.
We talked about it, like, 3 weeks ago. Yeah. We've already forgotten the title. So, they come to France for the
publication.
For the publication of Catherine Deneuve, of Fabian's
memoirs.
And in the memoir,
which she has entitled
The Truth. And in the memoir, there is all sorts of untrue and misinformation, untrue stuff, misinformation. You know,
Juliette Binoche has pulled out the red pen for this one.
Because, as you might guess, they have an estranged relationship.
Yes.
But also one where they feel like they are still sort of inextricably linked, and not simply because of the biological bond, but it's a give and take, you know, love-hate relationship that they have. And that's the movie. We are shown Catherine Deneuve on a set of a film where apparently it's this big concept sci-fi thing where she's aging in real time, but her own mother, played by Manon Clavel, who's, this is also like one of her first things as well, where her mother stays like 30.
In space.
In space or wherever, but like Catherine Deneuve's...
Every time she comes back, her daughter is like eventually older than her and is eventually played by Catherine Deneuve.
Yes.
And there's all these connections to the past. Like, it's a movie that's about the future, but the woman who is playing, you know, the astronaut in this film is being touted as like, oh, she is the new, I forget the name of the actress.
Uh-huh.
That actress had been a friend of Deneuve's and actually was did much more of the raising of Juliette Binoche than Catherine Deneuve ever did.
Yeah.
And so all these things become kind of intertwined. The whole thing about the astronaut mother only popping down to Earth every few decades also has this metaphorical weight to it. The fact that Binoche is a screenwriter herself and does her own embellishments on what one might consider the truth is a connection for them. It falls in the sort of like Postcards from the Edge, Autumn Sonata category of contentious but loving mother-daughter relationships where they're both artists and they're both, you know, in competition, and where the mother in her pursuit of excellence as an artist was maybe not always the greatest mother, and, you know, it there's a lot happening here.
Kore-eda has such a gentle style with even subject matter that could turn melodramatic or tormented with another filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you might look at this subject matter and think, are they going to scream at each other at some point? And the answer here is no, they're not going to scream at each other. They are going to talk and talk and talk and talk, and you're going to see them be fallible and see their own memories conflict with each other. And you're going to see how their behavior affects everyone around them.
Yeah. How it affects Juliette Binoche, who is now a mother herself.
Yeah. And so what this is a very low-key, very generous film about family dynamics and how you learn to make it through with people that you can't disconnect yourself from.
Right. And also can't change in a huge way.
You can't change them at all.
Yeah.
Catherine Deneuve is so great and so, like, cleverly self-aware mm-hmm. of the character she's building and how the audience is clearly looking at her
right.
and seeing Catherine Deneuve as Catherine Deneuve.
She's playing a character who's never not performing, so she has to bring that into her actual performance.
There's such a wonderful moment where she has to apologize to someone, and she has Juliet Binoche
write
the apology for her. So that she can then act it out in person.
Perform it.
And the person who's being apologized to goes, yeah, I know she wrote that for you. Like,
it's somebody who's close enough to her to know exactly what's going on.
Right.
And to still accept it on the, you know, in the way that it's presented. Yeah, no, I love this movie a lot. I got to see it early.
Where did you see it, Alonzo? Tell me where. Tell me where you saw it.
It was at the premiere of the Venice Film Festival.
Was it? Were you in Italy?
Yes.
Before the terribleness, and you were having gelato on the boat and the
it was not
on the gondola. Were you like on the gondola eating gelato?
Like, I've never been on the gondola because the gondolas are so expensive.
Oh, are they?
Oh, yeah.
How much are they?
It's such a touristy thing. It's like 100 euros to get on the gondola. Yes.
No.
Yes. I mean, you can get on like the Vaporetto, which is like the boat bus.
That's not
that takes you across
thing.
The Grand Canal and stuff.
That's
but no,
not the I've same
never,
thing.
I've never gotten on a gondola in Venice. It's too much.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Fancy Pants here saw this movie in Venice.
Almost a year ago. I'd like to watch it again.
I watched it on the TV. Of course.
This is where we're watching everything now. And this was a movie that was set to open theatrically, and then they pushed it back, and they pushed it back, and they're like, meh, and we're just going to stream it.
Anyway, it's lovely.
Yes, absolutely.
And I give it my wholehearted endorsement because I love the way Corrieta handles emotions without histrionics.
Yeah. He is a humanist director.
Absolutely. And I'm a big, big fan.
Yeah. All right. So check that out.
Do you have a DVD?
I do.
What is it?
So the Criterion Collection periodically does a thing with Barnes & Noble, where if you order their stuff from Barnes & Noble, it's 50% off. So it is a steal for people who are super into movies and into physical media, and you should be into physical media because streaming stuff just, you know, comes and goes on a whim. If you want to own something permanently, you know, I gotta have that Blu-ray, have that DVD.
Oh, wait.
What?
Oh, wait.
Oh, what?
We almost forgot.
What?
To do the ad spot.
Oh, my golly.
Let's do it now.
You're right.
Holy cow.
We got so...
We got embroiled.
Yes. Oh, man. This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by the lovely people at Ovid.tv.
Hope they didn't want it at the top of the show.
They have not specified.
Look,
so
people listen all the way through.
Oh, absolutely. Wouldn't stop for a thing. Ovid is different. They are started with the help of 8 independent film studios, and they now stream more than 800 titles, most of which cannot be found elsewhere in the streaming universe, and they add 20 to 35 new films a month, and unlike other services, they don't drop nearly as many. So if you're a subscriber to Ovid.tv, their collection is always growing. There's always more stuff for you to watch. So even if you've got, you know, Netflix and Hulu and HBO Max and Disney Plus, this is different stuff. Ovid is an alternative. It is the home for the best independent films, global cinema, social issue, and documentary films. Films from an independent world. What do they got now?
Among
many other things.
Here's what I watched this week.
What's that?
63 Boycott.
Oh.
And here's why I want to talk about it. First of all, one of the things I love about Ovid, and we're still doing the ad, but I'm just speaking, you know.
Yes.
I'm speaking from the heart.
Extemporaneously and honestly.
One of the things I love about Ovid is that they show lots and lots and lots of important short films.
Yes.
Like, short documentaries that are impossible to find
indeed
in other places. 63 Boycott is a 2017 documentary from Gordon Quinn. It's 30 minutes.
Hmm.
I didn't know where it was. I didn't know it existed. Here it is. It's about the 1963 Chicago Public School boycott, when 250,000 black students marched and boycotted school to protest segregation. They
school protests, you say?
They called for the resignation of the superintendent, Benjamin Willis, because rather than let black students whose schools were overcrowded,
mm-hmm.
rather than let them attend nearby schools that were designed specifically for white students,
mm-hmm.
they instead put trailers on parking lots and playgrounds and just had classes in those.
Yeah.
And they called them Willis wagons.
Mm.
And so they boycotted school.
Wow.
For the sake of desegregating Chicago schools. So not only is this a short documentary that you probably can't find anywhere else,
mm-hmm.
not only is it about racial justice, something that has been in the news of late, and furthermore, it's about boycotting schools, which is fixing to be in the news.
Oh, yes.
Because so many schools in the United States right now have been closed since the beginning of the virus. And now a lot of thoughtless, irresponsible, reckless, terrible school districts
are trying to force them back.
Are trying to force teachers and kids to come back to schools. Specifically, I learned this morning, Orange County schools are demanding that they voted mm-hmm. last night to start school again.
Yes.
In person.
Yes.
In the school with no safety precautions for anyone.
Yeah. They're not going to require masks or social distancing.
They are requiring nothing be changed or different.
Yeah. So I think a lot of parents and a lot of teachers.
It's time for a strike.
Are ready to boycott, are ready to strike, mm-hmm. are ready to not play along with this.
It's time for a school strike. It's time for a general strike.
Yeah.
In this country, because the more this happens, the more the people above you tell you, you have to go back to this place so that you can make money.
For us.
For me.
Yeah.
Tell them what they can do with it. Because not only is it non-binary day, y'all, it's Bastille Day.
Yes.
And that's when the guillotines come out.
Storm the walls. So if you want to, if you want some suggestions on historical precedents regarding this sort of thing, or films on any number of topics from any number of places in the world featuring some of the finest filmmakers who ever lived, Ovid offers a 14-day trial period. After that, it's just $6.99 a month or $69.99 yearly.
You don't need Apple TV Plus. You need this.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Head over to www.ovidtv. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, .tv. They've just launched a new platform and design. Take a look, get your subscription started, and, plunge into le cinema. Anyway, getting back to my DVD pick this week. So the semi-annual, I don't know how frequently it happens, but the Barnes & Noble Criterion sale is happening right now. And so because of the 50% off thing, it's a good time to invest in some of the big deep-seated Criterion box sets that they do so well. And launching today is the Bruce Lee box set from Criterion that is called Bruce Lee, His Greatest Hits, and it features his movies The Big Boss, Fist of Fury, The Way of the Dragon, Enter the Dragon, and Game of Death, and it's got, of course, tons of special features. If you want to save some money and have something that you're going to want to have in your movie library forever and ever, check out the Criterion Bruce Lee box for 50% off at Barnes & Noble through August 2nd. And that wasn't even an ad. I'm just telling
you. I know. You make it sound like an ad.
I'm just, I'm trying to save people some money.
You trying to drum up Barnes & Noble sponsorship for this show?
Not holding my breath.
Hey, Barnes & Noble.
If you're listening, Barnes & Noble.
You should, I don't know, give us money. We'll say nice things about you.
We'll promote the Nook.
Even though, I'll tell you what, back in the 90s, I don't think it is.
Okay.
Back in the 90s, Barnes & Noble was the enemy. Because they were the ones coming in and destroying all the little
Mom
stores.
Pops, yeah.
Yeah.
The Buns and Noodle, as they were referred to in Dykes to Watch Out For. However, yeah. I got to give it up to Barnes & Noble. When I did my Christmas book tour 10 years ago, there was one city where the local indie bookstore was supposed to set up my book signing. And at the last minute, they were like, what? We forgot? And Barnes & Noble stepped in at the last minute and made it happen.
Was this Austin?
Maybe. So Barnes & Noble always got a good...
People too high.
Got a check mark from me after that. What's your DVD pick of the week?
Well, last week I watched God's Little Acre.
Oh, brother.
Oh, my God.
Did you watch it for more than 5 minutes at a time? It felt like you spent an entire week getting through that movie.
It took me a few days to watch. I watched it in chunks.
Yeah. In heaps, one might say.
In sweaty segments. The poster for this movie says, it's on the screen. The explosive, lusty story that 20 million readers said could never be made. It was based on a book.
Yes.
About a...
a huge... Like, until Valley of the Dolls, I think it might have been the best-selling novel in America.
Really?
Point. Yeah.
More than Peyton Place?
I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, God's Little Acre is about a family in Georgia that is unhinged. They are. They're poor. They are cotton farmers. They are... horny. They are constantly dirty. They're always yelling. They're always fighting. They are... What's the right word to say here? They desire one another in ways that are occasionally unsavory. And
this is the guy.
It is such hicksploitation.
Yeah, if you've ever watched a documentary about like how Appalachia is portrayed in Hollywood cinema, you have invariably seen clips from God's Little Acre,
even though it's set in Georgia.
Right.
Yeah.
As a friend of mine in Virginia said, he had a professor who said, "I am not a hillbilly. I am a mountain William."
But here's how they sold this movie. By not, it's not meant to be, you know, edifying or instructive.
Just sweaty.
Or yeah, just sweaty. Like the poster, it's a black and white film, but the poster is in color.
Hmm.
Okay.
Not uncommon.
It's a frame from the film that has been like painted, mm-hmm. right?
In lurid Technicolor.
In the luridest mm-hmm. Technicolor. Tina Louise in a slip.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Okay. Aldo Ray in just a pair of pants. That's it. And they are on opposite sides of a corner of a house. So there's a corner and she's facing, you know, out and he's facing out, mm-hmm. but they're not looking at each other, but their hands are around the corner, touching,
clasped.
Touching. No, 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 not oh. clasped. Oh. Touching each other's thighs and other, you know, parts. Because they get up in the night. It's such a hot...
Who can sleep when it's so sultry?
It's such a hot night. That's a line of dialogue, by the way.
I don't doubt it.
Aldo Ray says to Tina Louise in this very famous scene, "It's so hot. I couldn't sleep." She says, "You're right. It's so hot." You can see the sweat on both of them.
Uh-huh.
If this had been made now, They'd have been just rutting in the yard. Well, but, like, it's...
It was this crazy period where if you wanted, like, actual dirty stuff, you had to go to novels or plays.
Yeah.
And then eventually those novels and plays would become so successful that Hollywood would make them into movies, but Hollywood couldn't do them that way because of the production code. So you get these, like... You get a lot of sweat, and that's about the only, you know, bodily fluid being, you know, presented.
Tina Louise and Aldo Ray, they really want each other, but oopsie, he's married to her sister.
Oh, dang it. Well, for darn.
And then, so, like, the whole movie's about, you know, the folly of these people.
Mm-hmm.
But it revels in the most exploitation-based stuff that it can.
Of course.
And that's really what it's about. It's just about people being horny in 100-degree heat.
That's a story.
It is. So I saw it on TCM, and it was restored by the UCLA Film Preservation Archive. And I'm like,
cinema!
Why? And the reason TCM picked it up for me is because I've got my 50s movie boyfriend, Aldo Ray,
yes,
in the DVR. And anything that comes on TV that he's in, just it gets picked up.
The stuff that your Aldo Ray and your Ida Lupino wish lists come up with, because they had this, they both had like very busy Hollywood periods.
Yeah.
And then they popped up in like every 60s, 70s for Ida Lupino up until like JAG in the 90s TV show.
Yeah.
It's such a random mixed bag of things.
There's a JAG episode coming up that she's in. Yeah. But anyway, because Aldo Ray is my 1950s movie boyfriend, everything comes up that he's in, and there's so many films of his that I just haven't seen yet.
Right.
So, you know, I watched...
Where he is often wearing an undershirt.
Where he's not never wearing an undershirt.
Well, and only an undershirt.
I mean. Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like... He was cast in that era to be a very specific kind of dude.
Yeah.
Like a big, giant lug.
Right.
And they could not get him out of a shirt fast enough in most of those films. Like, he was always not wearing a shirt.
He had the career that that guy from Sex Kittens Go to College wanted to have.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The lunk-headed football player dude.
Right.
All right, so okay, we already did letters, so golly, I guess we're at the end.
Yes, we are. We're at the end.
Thank you for listening, everybody. We have a Patreon.
Sure, yeah, I guess we do.
We absolutely do.
Yeah, sure we do.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. So much extra content, so many other opportunities to listen and interact and whatnot. So check that out. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check out our friends on the internet. Well, for starters, please go listen to all of my other podcasts. I'm currently co-hosting Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network, and Max Fun Drive is happening. It's a more low-key Max Fun Drive than usual, but we are still doing it. If it's something that you are interested in and can help out with, please do. There's a lot of great shows on that network, and the money that's raised during the Fun Drive helps keep them all happening. You can also hear me on Breakfast All Day with Christy Lemire and Matt Achety, and sometimes Ben Mankiewicz, my old What the Flick co-hosts. And my newest show, A Film and a Movie, over at the Bramble Jam podcast with Dan from Deck the Hallmark. Every week, the two of us, and very often a guest critic, will talk about a classic movie and the new movie, the newer movie that it inspired or, you know, is otherwise connected to.
I'm going to be a guest soon.
You are.
But not talking about the films we thought we were going to talk about.
Nope, but something cool anyway.
Yeah.
And nonetheless, let's see, you know, check out ChristyLemire.com. Go over to the Critically Acclaimed Network and see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to. Listen to The Schmoes Know. Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon. All Things Cozy. Sewers of Paris. Deck the Hallmark. Fat Guys at the Movies. Criterion Cast. The Big Fat Gay Podcast. And Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a beautiful 5-star review. We will read it here on the show. You can also leave positive feedback in the many other places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. Follow him on Twitter at Bluetopia, BLEUTOPIA. And thank you, Ovid.tv, for your sponsorship. We'll be back next time with more. And until then,
goodbye.